All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of yesterday and today, and try to make it all make some sense. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing editor, Natasha Bogutsky.
Aww. And seated across the microphone from me, always, is the incomparable Rich Trees.
I do not pay her to say that, but it's awfully nice that she does. Hi, good morning. This is a little bit of an earlier record for us than normal, but I'll still be dropping this on like Monday or Tuesday of the week.
Yes, I am leaving to go out of town in a few hours. So
yes, having a great girls' weekend with a couple of your girlfriends.
I am
heading up to Manhattan for some high art.
Yes, we are attending the opera.
Ooh.
but no, I wanted to make certain that this was on the books before we left. We just got done seeing Dune about not even 12 hours
true.
Ago.
Dune Part 2, yes.
Yes, Dune Part 2.
And just before we dive into our thing, I just want to say, while you're at the opera, I will be sitting at home watching the Marx Brothers A Night at the Opera. So it's all good. It's all good.
I was half tempted just for the one scene to have us all watch Pretty Woman before we left. But I'm like, I can't put him through that kind of torture.
Oh, come on. I haven't watched Pretty Woman in forever, but I feel that it probably holds up fairly well.
I remember
thinking this is
delightful
a good movie.
About 15 years ago.
It wasn't my cup of tea when it came out.
Yeah.
And I do have somewhere on a hard drive an earlier draft of the script when it was called, I think, the $10,000 date or something like that, that was much darker.
Yeah, I've heard it's pretty dark.
Doesn't have a happy ending. They don't, you know, he doesn't come back and sweep this hooker with a heart of gold who doesn't really do stuff, but is still a hooker.
Yeah,
kind of off her feet. Yeah,
think just now that I'm replaying Pretty Woman in my head over the past couple of years, I probably haven't watched it in about 10-15.
Mm-hmm.
I can see where the movie was supposed to end. And probably didn't play well in a test screening. And they had to go back and reshoot a new ending.
I don't know if they had to do that, but I could see where somebody at some point said, no, we need to make this a more commercial ending.
Yeah.
Shall we say. I think, was that screenwriter J.F. Lawton on the original?
I honestly can't remember. Sorry.
I think it was. For some reason, that's stuck in my head because he also wrote the Howard Stern movie Private Parts.
What? You just watch my head pretty much explode with that knowledge.
Yeah, that was fun.
A glitch.
You know, folks, when you watch an old TV show or a movie from the 60s where a person is playing a robot and the robot is supposed to suddenly collapse because somebody presented something that violates logic to them, you know, like every third episode of Star Trek, and you see like the person kind of go like, make that weird face and, you know, twitch around a little bit, and then they speed the film up to make it look even faster. That's what I just saw in real time. Oh, I know. Austin Powers International Man of Mystery, the only good one of the three films. When the fembot starts to, like, shake her head and everything after he does his, you know, mojo in his Speedo. That's what that looked like to me. Without you having to undergo the horror of seeing me in a Speedo, of course.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
But, yeah, no, my brain could not compute that knowledge.
It's fun to look at people's IMDb page sometimes and you just go, oh, that's a great movie. That's a great movie. That's a great movie too, but what? How do you get from that to that? You know, so.
It's a job.
It sometimes is. I mean, okay, case in point. Peter Jackson, low budget horror films, slightly higher budget horror film with The Frighteners. And then he does something really different, like Heavenly Creatures. But none of that really kind of hints at
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings. What you're going to get with Lord of the Rings. So, yeah, it's always great. And that's what's wonderful about movies.
Although he did bring a couple of scenes. I mean, Bilbo's lash out in Rivendell is pure horror. That's pure Jackson going, I got to get a little something of mine in there.
That's a great jump scare, yes.
Yeah.
But speaking of range, let's dive into Dune and go, hey, aren't we glad that Fayed Rutha didn't have an Elvis accent?
You had to go there.
Yeah, I know. That's the only way I could segue us in. But anyways, Dune Part 2, as you are hearing this, has opened. We just saw it last night, Thursday night. I had seen it a week prior on IMAX for the Philadelphia Film Critics Circle. Our podcast review is already out there floating around.
I want to see it on IMAX.
Maybe next weekend we'll take a trip to Philly. So, and it's amazing. I think, okay, review over, done. We'll see you next time.
Wow.
It's flabbergasting.
I was a little tipsy too when I went in to see it, so that actually helped, like, open up the experience for me.
Thank goodness we weren't on any of, like, those D-box or those motion-moving seats, because that would have been crazy. Now, here's the thing.
That would have been awesome.
I mentioned, you know, that I saw it on IMAX. It's beautiful on IMAX. One of my colleagues there at the Film Critics Circle, Dan Tabor, who writes for Synapse, he went and saw it again on a second critics slash influencer screening in Dolby DX. Mm-hmm. And he said the Dolby, the sound mix and everything in that is amazing. So if you're looking for what version of presentation to see this movie in, I'm going to go with what my friend Dan says and say go to the Dolby. I would like to. I thought the sound mix was really nice where we saw it last night. I think it wasn't, it wasn't Dolby, it wasn't IMAX, it was just the conventional theatrical sound mix, and it worked really well. Mm-hmm. But again, sometimes you want that little extra kick in the bass.
I have a feeling it would be amazing during the Colosseum scene.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, I was in another world.
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I was, mm-hmm. I was far out, man. I'm staring at that screen, I'm like, oh. There were a couple times I definitely adjusted my seat to make myself feel sit up higher. I was feeling the movie. I wasn't watching it. I felt like I was part of it.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Now, I will say, too, beyond the Colosseum scene, Dan pointed out anytime they're on a worm, riding mm-hmm. the worm, he goes, this movie lets you ride the worm. And I jokingly said to him, ride the worm? Well, there's your poster quote right there. You know, if this was a 90s movie. But overall, this film, pretty much, you better have seen Dune Part 1, because this just kind of drops you, boom.
Right in.
Right into the story. You get a hair of some recap in that first scene with the princess and the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, no, you are right into...
Right where they left off.
20 minutes after, after credits rolled on the last one. In fact, you could probably very easily edit the two of them together into like one 6-hour long or 5.5-hour long experience if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be fun too.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I think actually the first film, as well as it plays, probably plays well better if you were to watch them back to back or, smushed together like that. Simply because there's a lot of setup in the first half, and much of it is paid off in part two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get a bit of a character arc for Paul in the first half of him going from, kind of a dilettante to accepting his role as I am the heir to Duke Leto, and I'm going to have to seek revenge, so I'm going to have to hang out with these desert dwellers now. But it doesn't really pay off in a larger way until all of this movie.
Yeah.
And in some ways, the outlander coming into a culture, learning their ways, leading them in a rebellion for their freedom, feels like Lawrence of Arabia in outer space to me. And I love it. It has that same type of epic grandeur, has that same type of hero who's filled with self-doubt about what he is doing and a revulsion of what he knows will come from his actions due to the death and destruction that this fight will ultimately lead to. I don't know if Brian Herbert's ever really, the writer of the original novel, didn't ever really address that in any interview
Frank
or anything.
Frank Herbert,
excuse me. Brian Herbert is his son. Frank Herbert wrote 6 Dune novels. Brian wrote another dozen with Kevin J. Anderson based on notes and stuff from his father. I can't be too critical of that because I'm a J.R.R. Tolkien fan. And in my spare room with all the books, I have
a lot of Chris.
About two bookshelves, not bookcases, but at least 2 shelves full of Christopher Tolkien books.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Can't be too critical there. So what was your initial deeper impressions besides, oh, my God, it was amazing?
Well, let me get past the, oh, gee, wow, yeah. Too. I love the character arcs that everyone seems to go through. I like Zendaya as the antithesis of dealing with the fundamental religion and how she bucks it.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that stories and prophecies are just someone's way of trying to control you, and it is your faith that it initially will end up enslaving you to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you spend your life waiting for something, waiting for some sort of savior, you won't try to save yourself. I mean, I think that's always been the case. You're expecting Messiah, you wait forever for the Messiah to come. If he comes, you don't believe it's him. You will just keep on waiting because this thing is built up in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing real is ever going to actually compare to what you have in your head.
Mm-hmm. And well, that and, you know, to kind of get secular outside of this movie for a moment, if you are in a faith that has a lot of prophecy in it,
mm-hmm.
and you feel, well, the fulfillment of that prophecy is really good for me and really bad for everybody else who's not me, and therefore I don't like them to begin with, you may try through means to interpret that philosophy in a certain way where you can influence events and think, oh, I am making this happen because I'm helping that this thing happened here, or I see this thing happening and I'm going to say that's part of the prophecy. So I'm going to push this other piece of the prophecy or how I interpret it forward. So you're trying to make it happen itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much, I guess, self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
Yeah.
I know with my Catholic upbringing, I always rebel against that idea or people who I see act like that simply because, you know, the day of the Lord cometh like a thief in the night. You don't know when it's going to be. And it's kind of presumptuous to tell God that, hey, I put the pieces in place. Now you can do it, right? And God probably just looks down on you and she says, no, just for that, I'm going to hold off another 3,000 years.
Meh.
Or something like that, you know, which is nothing to me and everything to you. Sorry.
Yeah.
So you have that happening with the character of Stilgar, I think, in a little bit. He's right. But I think that's an interesting tension that can be found in the movie.
And, particularly between those two characters.
And if you care, you can probably find that in today's culture as well. And we'll leave that for you to discover.
I also like how, in order to do that, he puts Lady Jessica in a very strong position of power within his own tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know she's useful. She's a weirding woman. She's Bene Gesserit. Their reverend mother is dying. They need a new one. They could have chosen probably any one of the reverend mother's, I guess you'd say, handmaidens who were helping her. But instead, he goes to the outsider and pulls her so far in that she has the ability to influence. That's a lot of power to just drop on a stranger.
True.
That's kind of scary.
But that's him maneuvering something he saw mm-hmm. into a position to fulfill a prophecy.
Yeah.
So this is the first. Okay. I read Dune back in the 80s after the movie came out that David Lynch had directed. I think I might have reread it once since then. I've, you know, watched the Lynch version a couple of times. I remember watching the Sci-Fi Channel version, which was a 5-hour miniseries. Mm, yeah.
I'm sorry for James McAvoy. in Children of Dune.
But, you know, the first time, you know, I was really thinking about this last night while we were watching this, and this is my second time watching part two, that Stilgar kind of pushing that and kind of making that self. What if ultimately, I mean, he was, it is what it is in the film, but I was gonna say, an interesting alternative version of the story would be, what if Paul wasn't the person who was supposed to fulfill the prophecy? They just pushed him into that role, and then that person rises up a generation later to oppose Paul. And that's an entirely different way that this book series could have gone. Again, something, you know, I was thinking about last night. I was like, oh, that'd be an interesting way to take it. It's not where they do, but I mean, the elements are there, which I think ultimately speaks to the fact that this movie has a lot going on. I mean, it's drawing from the book series, obviously, but I see where other adaptations have failed, really, in trying to get this kind of complexity. We're looking at 5.5, almost 6 hours of film here, and they still leave out stuff from the book.
You have to know what to cut, what to keep. I mean, I was talking to Darren about that, my husband, on the ride home last night, and he mentioned, well, the sister never comes in, really. She doesn't really play a part. You know, at this point, Shawnee and Paul, this takes over years in the book.
Yeah.
But here, it's within Lady Jessica's pregnancy.
Yeah.
Because she hasn't even given birth.
They compact 5 years down to about 6 months.
I know, yeah. And I said to him, as an adaptation, you need to know what is okay to alter, what needs to be cut in order to propel your story forward. They have presented the fact that his little sister is there in the womb. She can hear things. She's very powerful. We have a vision of her, what she's going to be like in the future. But to bring in another character would muddy up a story that needs to be as simple as possible with an emotional attachment in order to get the actual world building and political complexities. Mm-hmm. You need to keep your characters tight. As a television medium, maybe you could go into that a lot more because you have a lot more time you can spend on it.
But I think,
and I compared it to Tolkien, particularly with Arwen. Arwen was given a lot more to do in the film than she had in the books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because they needed to streamline some of the story.
Yeah. Well, I think back in the 80s, saying we're going to do a two-part adaptation of a film is absolutely unheard of unless you were The Godfather. So Lynch, you know, had to compact all of that book down into 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I think in terms of getting plot across, he does a fairly decent job.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't have the room to dig into a lot certain of the complexities, into the mythos a bit, in terms of thematical material. You know, it just doesn't resonate. You don't get an idea really about the Fremen's religious fervor or even the factions within their religion the way you do here.
Okay, so I actually kind of want to talk about something in the book. Shawnee understood Princess Aurelian and the decision that Paul made. Here, she storms off.
Yes.
I like this better.
It does give her more agency. And I think, you know, having to watch the man you love be in a marriage of convenience while you're technically his royal side piece is not as tragic an ending as her feeling betrayed by what he had to do.
Bingo.
And it's not just like an emotional betrayal on his part to her. It's a betrayal of the idea that he was just like, look, I just want the revenge. I don't want anything else. And she sees that by him becoming that religious leader. And that's, you know, immediately where she gets pissed off.
The moment he takes the water and becomes the Kutsa-Kadarak, you could tell she's losing him.
Mm-hmm.
From the first moment he steps up on the dais and tells everyone pretty much, shut the fuck up.
He's doing everything he told her he wasn't going to do.
Mm-hmm. I even noticed that when they all kind of are reacting when he's up on that dais, and everyone's reaching for their weapons. She does as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to watch her, you know, her internal battle of her culture coming up against the man that she loves. But seeing what he has become. When he says to her, I need you to know I will love you for as long as I breathe. Right before turning around and saying to the Emperor, I'll settle for the hand of your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
It is sincere. But at the exact same time, it's the last nail in the coffin.
Yeah. And it is a moment and a change that could conceivably make Chani look more naive. Like, but you said you love me and now you want to go marry, you know. But they lay the foundation for it so well that even though, you know, we're compacting their entire 5-year relationship in the book down to 6 months. I mean, remember in the book, they have a yeah. son who gets killed when the Siege is attacked.
Yeah, I know.
I think, you know, Villeneuve and John Spates, his co-writer on the adaption, handle this material so well. I think, yes, there are changes like that, like the compression of time. I think they're handled so well, though, that they work within the movie itself. That's the process of adaption. And that's what makes it work so, so well.
Agreed. I really loved everything about that. By the way, got to talk some performance stuff here. Florence is fantastic, is Irulan. I love what they've done with her. In the Lynch version, she was just kind of
there at the end.
There.
Yeah.
At the beginning and at the end.
That's Virginia Madsen.
Mm-hmm. Whereas here, she not only is an active part, she's a force. I feel like she is definitely a commanding force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love, I mean, I know she says, I'll be your willing bride, but her character feels like if I was watching some sort of political historical show like The Tudors or something, she would be the queen who's just kind of doing everything from the shadows. She's creating her own rebellion. She's taking things on. She's plotting against her husband. Like, I can picture all that. That's not exactly what happens here, but like, that's what I could picture yeah. for this version of this character.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is helping plant seeds for what's going to come if they do an adaptation of Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. We also see, you know, one or two other elements that are kind of planted ahead of time for a hopeful third film in this franchise with Lea Seydoux's Lady Margot character.
Mm-hmm.
I really not sure that was in the book at all. I can't remember.
Lady Margot?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was there.
Oh, and what she does with Fayed?
I don't remember if that was there.
Because I'm reasonably sure that pays off later on down the road.
I'm not surprised.
Yes. So hopefully we'll have more because this is an amazing piece of filmmaking. Just the epic broad stroke of it. There's not a, you know, not a false note. Can we talk about the production design for this for a minute?
Okay. Yeah. I'm already looking at it going, Oscar, Oscar, Oscar for next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're looking at a world that, because there was an issue with artificial intelligence, you know, computers above a certain level are now outlawed. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a lot of shiny panels with flashy buttons and lights in the design here. And there's a real gritty reality to things. You know how you would watch an older science fiction movie and you look at kind of like their version of the future and it looks kind of dated?
Yeah. Oh, God,
you're like,
yeah.
Oh, that's the future in 1960s or that's the future in the 1970s or something like that. This movie feels like this design is not going to feel dated 10, 15, 20 years from now when you watch it.
Agreed. It's very organic.
I was going to say it draws a lot on like what feels like current technology and like the ornithopters and stuff like that. In terms of like tweaking the design just a little bit, it's recognizable, mm-hmm. but it's still different.
It's unique enough, and it's not so much in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the grittiness and the reality of the world around it, that when there are pieces of technology and machinery, they're meant to look just... They're supposed to blend. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to stand out.
Yeah.
One of the things I love, and I noticed this when I was watching the first film as well, their airships that look like dragonflies.
Mm-hmm.
When they all take to the sky at once, that is a terrifying sight.
Yes.
And yet, really unique, really cool. And like I said, it has an organic element to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything does. And yes. I appreciate that so much.
Another thing about the design of, like, when we were on Caladan and when we're on the Emperor's homeworld, and we're anywhere, really. These are giant spaces filled with very tiny people. These tiny people are making mammoth changes to the course of history in the galaxy, which is interesting. But also you have like these giant grand halls that feel very empty except for these small people interacting around in there. And it gives me the feel of like this is an empire that's in decline. It has seen its better days. You can see a little bit of grime around the edges.
Yeah.
And that I find very fascinating because I think that informs a lot. Before you even get to the idea that the Bene Gesserit's Quetzalcoatl genetic program has been going on for like, what, 90 generations, they say?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, almost 2,000 years right there. And probably, I'm not up on my Dune lore, probably was going on for a bit longer than that. So there's an incredible reality, like we keep coming back to, about all of this that I think is necessary and helps us connect more with the characters and the themes of like religion, environmentalism, technology, things like
Everything is linked to nature from what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. I mean, even down to the name that Paul chooses as his warrior name when he joins the Fremen, Muad'Dib, Desert Mouse. Everything links back to water or to animals or flora or fauna or mm-hmm. something natural in our world.
The promise of returning Dune to a green planet.
Mm-hmm. That being said, if it returns to a green planet, can we talk about what would happen to Shai Halud?
Yeah, there'd probably still need to be spaces for
that's essentially
and spice
their
yeah.
That is essentially their god.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an interesting
and their means
thought.
Of transport.
And as we're talking here, you know, we see them take the water from the fallen warrior and add it to the vast reservoir underneath the siege. And you get the idea that this is a seat that reservoir is filled almost, you know, exclusively with water from past Fremen,
mm-hmm.
which kind of means that your life, despite everything else you do, part of your life is just serving to collect water that ultimately goes into this reservoir that they feel is going to be used to make the planet green again. So you are part of a multi-generational process as well. Not just what the Bene Gesserit are doing, but over here in this other culture, it's a very far-looking, long-game plan.
And I love that about this. There's always the idea of revenge and what happens in the short term. But essentially, all of the major decisions that are made mm-hmm. in Dune are something that are going to affect hundreds, thousands of years, entire bloodline
yes.
gone. It's not something short.
Well, that's where the Fremen and the Bene Gesserit have a similarity in their religion, that they both have these long-term plans, and each generation is just a small wheel,
just
small
piece,
cog in that much larger, much longer-lived machine.
The Harkonnens.
Mm.
Let's talk the Harkonnens for a second.
Fun people to have as neighbors, I'm sure.
I don't know, I'm sure. I think they throw the wildest parties.
But you don't dare call the cops on them when it gets too loud.
Yes. They're the kind of people who just walk outside. They don't even need to carry the gun. And they look at the cops and go, get off my lawn.
Yeah, pretty much. So the Harkonnens. Harkonnens.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm still stuck on David Lynch pronunciations, so... and I don't know if there's a discussion that's been ongoing in Dune fandom for decades over this by now, but I will probably still always wind up calling them the Harkonnens. putting the accent on the wrong syllable, probably, but...
Yeah, you do that a lot.
I know.
So...
Good trait for a podcaster. So, anyways, you were leading into this.
Yes, at the Harkonnens. What did you think? We have a new player.
I really enjoyed their portrayal here. I think it's similar to Lynch's. Lynch likes to kind of, like, wallow around on the edges of excess. So, you get a bit more of people who are just, like, sadistic for the fun of being sadistic. You know, where you see the Beast Urban just sitting there laughing himself silly at stuff that his uncle is doing. You have that whole thing with the heart plugs and everything. And, you know, I'm blanking on the actor from the Lynch version who played the Baron. But he was, you know, he's fantastic. But he's also kind of over the top and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Here, there is a definite sadism to what they do. But it's in pursuit of power. It's in pursuit of personal wealth. And they understand, or they feel their understanding of the world is the only way you get ahead is by being sadistic. And you can't be a good person. There was a line somewhere where the Emperor even says, you know, Duke Leto's problem was he tried to lead with his heart. And you can't do that. And that made him weak, which in Paul's eyes actually made him strong. And that's an interesting discussion that doesn't get into in the movie, but I think the movie at least presents that question.
I appreciate that Austin Butler coming in to play Fade Rafa. Whoa.
It's insane. He's so good. Yeah. This is a support. I mean, we haven't even gotten to this year's Academy Awards. That's next weekend. But if I had to place any money for an early contender for a Best Supporting Actor nomination, it's going to be him.
This film is too much of an ensemble to pick out any one particular performance.
If he's not in the conversation, at least.
He'll probably be in the conversation, but he won't make it to the nominations. The movie came out way too early. But holy crap. And I saw something somewhere where Stellan Skarsgård had said that his first day on set with Austin, he couldn't stop laughing at Austin.
How so?
Because he could see just how much Austin was enjoying the devilish glee of being so evil and sadistic. He was just having the time of his fucking life with it, and Stellan was getting the biggest kick out of that.
That's fair. I mean, it's a fun – I don't want to say it's a fun performance because that sounds weird. But it's a really good performance, and it feels real. It feels real. And as you watch it, yeah, you get a little bit of like – okay, he's having fun being evil here.
He's got some serious predator eyes.
Because the character is such a freaking psychopath.
Yeah.
That
he doesn't need to go over the top with it.
Yeah.
And I think working with Stellan a lot probably helped him rein in any of those impulses to take it big. Yeah. Stellan plays things very low, but layered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes him a lot of times when he's doing roles like that so fucking terrifying. So having that person kind of mentoring you through your own journey, that's a good family unit right there.
Oh, yeah.
Except for when he's trying to kill him by not drugging the slave in the arena. Mm-hmm. Yes, I got that, by the way.
I don't think he was trying to kill Fayed. I think he was trying to toughen him up. And make sure that he understood that you can bloody your knife with someone who's not handicapped in the fight, you know, and it's a nice little moment to give us to the end of Dr. Hewer. But
that is not what I saw.
Okay. How did you see that?
You said it yourself. The Harkonnens do what they do. They're not sadistic, not just for the sake of being sadistic. They're sadistic for power and wealth.
Mm-hmm.
This is his name day. This is his birthday celebration. What better way than to give him the chance to die because you're too much of a threat to me? Or if you survive, I can use you to gain even more political power.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why he says, you tried to kill me in the arena. And he goes, you know, yes, he toughened him up.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, he, if I remember correctly in the book, he did try to kill him.
Okay.
And when it backfired on him, he went, no, I know, I can see what you're made of. And I'm going to maneuver you into a position where
you could become emperor.
Yeah. Which is why he does that when Fade confronts him after the arena scene.
Okay, that's possible. I mean, it is ambiguous on the point of at the beginning of the gladiatorial fight, we cut to the Baron and he says something along the lines of, happy birthday, my nephew, or whatever. Once everybody realizes, hey, that one guy he's fighting isn't drugged. It's going to be an actual fair fight. I think the gift was, you know, him saying, I'm seeing the measure of your worth. The book allows you to know that, you know, the Baron was maybe a little bit cautious or on guard about Fayed's power and possibility of being a threat to his own life. I think the movie doesn't necessarily give us that.
No, you need to play with it a little bit more. Yeah.
And I'm fine with what the movie does give us, because ultimately it shows the Baron still manipulating Fayed, saying, okay, I've just shown you that you can kill and you have that ability within you. And if things come to pass, I'm going to put you on the throne. So you need to be ready. I mean, again, it's a slight difference, and that just comes through the process of adaptation. But I like it.
I was happy to see Christopher Walken back.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't walk in all over the place.
Well, his delivery it did have some pauses in there. I don't think he's like, you know, super Christopher Walken mode here.
No.
But there is a little bit of that. I think overall, though, he does play a certain defeated attitude by the end, which I think works.
Yeah. And I was hoping for something a little more in line with, you know, when he did Deer Hunter. Like, I wanted to see someone that just cruel. Christopher Walken hasn't done a movie in almost 10 years. So the idea that he came out for this meant that either one, the paycheck was really, really fucking good and he needed it, or he had a connection to the source material and wanted to be a part of it. I'm hoping for the latter, because that would be the only thing that would get me really out. Like, Dune is not something you walk into and you're going to just mosey your way through. Like, I can tell Villeneuve chooses people and he puts their ass to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Walken has done a few things, but it's like the war with Grandpa and a couple of other dumb things in the last couple of years that probably weren't challenging and maybe were playing off of his.
I can't remember the last time he's done like a drama.
A drama, yeah.
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 And this is probably the closest thing that I've seen in a long time. He only has about 15 minutes of screen time here. But he fills them, and you're right, with that defeatist attitude. He's flanked on either side by Charlotte Rampling and Florence Pugh. Both of those women, the way that they hold themselves, even Charlotte, who's completely veiled and covered, you can tell in the stance, they are flanking to his side to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
And well, they will be...
By protecting him, they're protecting themselves.
Yes, exactly. But no, I didn't get the performance from Walken as much as I wanted to get from him. I would have liked to see earlier on in his first couple of scenes, really, that what am I looking for here? The strength, the vigor.
Mm-hmm. Of someone who rules an empire.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone who is...
He seems very zen at the beginning. A little too zen. So that by the time you get to him at the end, where he does look a little more downtrodden and defeated, it didn't feel like it was all that much of a leap. And I think if we had seen someone who was more vigorous and more of full power at the beginning, it would make the ending not only work so much better here, but it would also show the time gap a little bit more.
Yeah, you have a point there, and I agree. We don't have much of an arc for the Emperor. In the book, I don't think he has like one scene in the beginning and then shows up at the end. Mm. So, you know, that we didn't even get him at all in the first movie. They're kind of having to compact everything he has to do in the story into the second half, which is fine. But yeah, he does kind of go from eh to eh. It's not much of a drop.
No.
In terms of...
I mean, it's a drop. You can see it, but it's not as large of a drop as it possibly should have been. Paul. Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides. Fucking hail! Because holy shit. When I pictured Paul when I was watching the Lynch version as a kid, I mean, Kyle MacLachlan was... He was fine.
Mm-hmm.
He was okay. I had read some of Dune when I was younger, and I could not picture Kyle. Even after... No, when I went back to those pages after watching the Lynch version. You know, usually when you read something afterwards, you start picturing it with the faces of the actors you saw from whatever adaptation.
Yeah.
Paul was a blank face in my head. It is not often I actually say that. Kyle didn't fulfill that role for me. So he wasn't my stand-in. I didn't have a stand-in.
Hmm.
Now when I read it, it's forever going to be Timothée Chalamet because he delivers all the complexity, all the inner turmoil, all the outer rage.
And he doesn't have a whole lot of big scenes to do that.
Yeah.
But even in, like, the smaller stuff, he still carries a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it a great performance. I mean, Villeneuve does a lot of work with the Vision stuff was definitely a great thing that Lynch leaned into because that, you know, that kind of imagery appeals to him. That kind of dreamlike visuals is very much within his wheelhouse. So Lynch did a lot there. I think Villeneuve kind of dials back the intensity of some of that and manages to make it maybe almost lyrical in a way. And that relieves a little bit of the acting burden off of Chalamet's shoulders, perhaps. But he still, you know, brings everything he needs to in the smaller moments, which
once
allows...
he turns into the Quetzalcoatl, holy shit, get the fuck out of his way. he walks with purpose, he walks taller, there is a physical change in Timothy's performance. I'm not just talking his voice or his eyes, it's something in how he holds himself. Yes.
Do you want to know the last time I saw some really amazing physical, like just actor holding themselves up in a certain way change that this kind of reminds me of? Don't laugh. Christopher Reeve in the very first Superman movie, when he is at Lois's apartment as Clark Kent, picking her up for that date, and he's thinking about... He's kind of standing there. His shoulders are slumped. He's compressing his spine. And he has a look on his face. And he's thinking about telling her who he really is. And he takes off his glasses. And he straightens up. And his shoulders broaden out for a moment. And you suddenly go, oh, that's Superman. And I can see why no one thinks Clark Kent is Superman. Because it's just a minute little change in everything. but it is everything.
Yeah, no, I can
see
that.
And that's what I see here with what Chalamet is doing from pre-transformation to post-transformation.
The only other person that I could think of that really jumped to my mind when it came to that was James McAvoy of Split and...
Oh, okay, yeah.
And...
Glass.
Yeah. The way he can jump back and forth between the different characters. And sometimes... It happens in the face and in the mm-hmm. eyes, and sometimes it's just a body movement change, just one small little change, and then all of a sudden you know that person's gone and another one's taken its place. That's what Timothy's done here. When he woke up from the water, it was a whole other person. I did not see Paul Atreides, Duke of Arrakis. I saw Paul Muad'Dib Uso Atreides, Duke of Arrakis.
Exactly,
and it was like,
yes.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and I'm not sure we get that as much as I love Kyle MacLachlan. I don't think we get that in the Lynch version.
Mm-mm. No, he just kind of stays one note.
Yeah, he gets a moment where he holds up his Chris knife and yells, "Father, the sleeper has awakened." And then we go on to more mayhem and action.
I like Lynch's version, but I can't believe I'm going to say this, and there's going to be a lot of Lynch people out there, you know, screaming, "Burn the witch and crucify me for what I'm about to say." He chooses style over substance.
Well, that's, in this case, in his version of Dune, yes.
Yeah.
I don't think, I mean,
not a lot of his other films. I would just say with Dune.
Yeah. Lynch's Dune is gorgeous to look at.
Oh, it's stunning.
And for years, I would go back and rewatch it just because
a lot of it looks like paintings.
The design of the throne room for the emperor, the design of the thing that the guild navigators come in. Even like the guild navigators stage one, the guys in the long black trench coats with the microphone thing.
I mean, the costumes, you look at Aurelian's costume in the beginning, and it's very much based off of, I think, like mid-1700s England with the, mm-hmm. the high collars and the curled wigged hair. It feels very much of another time period. But here, what Villeneuve is trying to do is style is important, but not so much as the substance and the themes. It's like a good piece of cake. It has to look pretty, but it has to taste amazing.
Yes.
And if one of those things is out of whack, then the whole balance of everything is gone. Mm-hmm. And he finds the right balance here between acting and thematical and style and music. And it just comes together to make the perfect cake.
True. Now, let me ask you this. Villeneuve has put several years now into realizing his vision for this book, a 2-part movie adaptation, 5.5 hours long, probably, 5-6 years in the making. Do we want him to continue on making Dune movies for another book or two? Or do we want to see him now go off and do something else? Or, thirdly, go off, do something else, and then come back right back to this? Where would you like to see this? I mean, does this work really well? Do we want a third movie that could be equally as good? Or do we want to run the risk of maybe a third movie that's kind of like Peter Jackson's The Hobbit films? Looks pretty, but kind of doesn't work as well as the Lord of the Rings stuff.
I would be okay if he went off and did something for him
mm-hmm.
and then came back. But the thing is here is Dune is a passion project for him. And it has been ever since he was a kid. So when he was given the opportunity to do this, he wanted to make certain it was done right. I don't think he could screw it up.
Sort of what I felt about The Hobbit. But there were so many forces at play with The Hobbit, though.
Yeah,
I will admit that. And I will admit I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here a little bit.
A little bit. And the thing is Peter Jackson delivered with Lord of the Rings.
Yes, true. We will always have the first two
The Hobbit
movies. So if
went to pieces 10, 15 years later.
Yes.
Dune is sci-fi Lord of the Rings. It's it's Game of Thrones, and it is Star Wars all wrapped into one.
Mm-hmm. If you looked at that time period, I think Lord of the Rings as books came out a little bit earlier than Dune did. But
Dune was 65.
And I think, oh gosh, I'm blanking on Lord of the Rings.
I thought that was 40s or 50s.
Late 50s, early 60s, because the books came out, I think, once every 18 months or something like that. It doesn't matter, though. They were both very much the landmark works in their genre at the time of their publication. And they've
54.
Okay. And they've stood that tall ever since. And I think the adaptation we got here is probably going to stand the test of time the way that Jackson's films have stood the test of time, at least for 20 years. Go back a couple of months and listen to our podcast on the 20th anniversary of Return of the King if you don't believe us. And I think that if he does do another film in this franchise or not, that's not going to change the status of Dune. I would love to further explore this world. I'd love to follow Stilgar and the Fremen out on their jihad across the galaxy and see what kind of ramifications that has for Paul and everybody else. There's a lot to explore here. I did not read all of God Emperor of Dune. It was a tough slog that first 150 pages or so, and I kind of gave up on it. And that's where I checked out on the Dune series. But looking at Wikipedia, there's a lot of lore, a lot of things there to explore. Supposedly HBO Max has a
Sisterhood of Dune.
Yeah, Bene Gesserit series in development. They've had it in development for a long time.
Well, they also had a a strike to deal with, so of course nothing was in production.
True, but even before that, you know, they've been going through like a lot of script development and stuff like that, trying to, I guess, find a story that works. So hopefully we will see a lot more of this version of Frank Herbert's work.
I think that just about wraps us up for this week.
Indeed it does.
Remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, so either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe.
And if y'all like what you're hearing, please leave a positive review, because that always helps us connect with new listeners. Dune Part 2 right now is in theater, so rush right out, see it once, see it twice. Plan your soda consumption accordingly, because it is 3 hours of movie.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way last night.
We will be back next week with our hot takes first reaction show to a little thing called the Academy Awards.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Yes, that's right. It's the 96th annual Academy Awards. And I think this is going to be our 6th or 7th annual
oh my God.
Hot take show that we recorded right afterwards. But remember, this year, the Oscars start at 7, not 8 o'clock. They start an hour earlier, which is great because this means I get to bed at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time instead of 3 o'clock after doing all the editing and production work on the podcast to make sure it's available right there on Monday morning.
Okay, fine. And you can find that all right here on the Big Picture Podcast. I've been through the desert on a horse.